Well, I appreciate the chance to be here today and to talk about some of Glendon's contributions. I need to start by saying that, of course, that this title way overstates what actually can be accomplished today, that I can't even start to cover all of Glendon's legacy. But I want to talk just about a few of the things that that Glendon has contributed over the time that he's worked in soil physics. I first met Glendon about 50 years ago, and this is what he looked like then. He was a graduate student at Washington State University working with Walt Gardner. I was an undergraduate at Utah State University working for Sterling Taylor. And Sterling had sent me to Pullman to work with Glendon on a project that he was doing for his PhD research on linked transport of heat and water in soil. Now, I put in this slide of Glendon and his wife Shirley and three of their children from that time to remind us that there's more to life than science. It was during that trip to Pullman that I met the girl that I married a year later, and she's been my companion now for these almost 50 years. I'm pretty sure that I didn't do much to help Glendon out on the science that he was doing when I took that trip, but I still count that trip as a resounding success. Now, the reason that that Sterling wanted me to go to Pullman and wanted Glendon to work on this linked transport of heat and water was because WSU had a nuclear reactor and still has a nuclear reactor, a subcritical reactor. Walt had convinced the folks running the reactor to put a tube into the core of the reactor and get out a stream of neutrons that could be used to measure water content in soil. And this is a picture of the Cherenkov radiation coming from the core of the reactor in its swimming pool. This would have been a sight that Glendon would have often seen as he did his PhD research at WSU. Now, the reason that Sterling was interested in working with Glendon on this is kind of shown in this slide. This is an old graph from one of Walt Gardner's publications, and it shows the random emission errors from neutrons and then other sources of radiation used for that you could use for measuring water content. Now, a lot of you and a lot of other people have used neutron scattering for measuring moisture in soil, but Glendon is one of a very few soil physicists who ever used neutron attenuation. I had thought that no one used it anymore, that no one even was aware of it, but on a recent trip to Switzerland, found that Danny Orr and some of his students have now taken up that. But you can see in this graph, the random emission errors are the main ones that contribute to error in water content measurement. And here Walt has plotted the error from in the water content measurement versus column thickness. You can see that for thin columns that neutrons are probably at least an order of magnitude better than any other radiation source for making these measurements. Now, these a narrow column was what Glendon had for doing his experiments. He made soil columns that were about 10 centimeters long and about a centimeter thick. He applied a 10 degree Celsius temperature gradient across those, or temperature difference across those columns, and then he followed the thermally induced water flow that occurred within the columns, the water redistribution over time, and used the neutrons to measure that. Now, soil physicists' stock in trade, probably more then even than now, is the ability to build their own instruments. And I found this old power supply. They were cleaning out the soil physics lab at Washington State University last summer, and I went over there, and out in the hall was a lot of the kinds of things that I had worked on and Glendon and others that had been there had worked on. And amongst those things was this old power supply. This was one of the power supplies that Glendon built when he was there as a graduate student. You can see that it's mostly built out of war surplus parts. You can see here the big transformers that he had, the big capacitors on the back were some chokes that were needed to filter that power that was going to his Peltier coolers, and the diodes up here on the front. Looks a little bit crude, but it worked beautifully for those experiments. Here's one of the graphs from Glendon's thesis. This shows the water content in those soil columns versus the distance from the warm end of the column. And so the water content started out here, about 15%. And you can see that even, well, this dashed line is the temperature through the column over on this axis. You can see it starts out here, and even on the first day after heating starts, we get a reduction in the water content on the hot end, increase in the water content on the cold end, and over time we get the water distributing in the column so that the hot end finally gets down to a water content of about 6%, and the cold end up to a water content of about 26%. Now, Glendon wanted to try to separate out the liquid and the vapor flow in this column, and he did it by putting a chloride tracer in the column, and this graph shows the concentration of the chloride tracer along with the water content. Now, this is plotted in the opposite direction of the last graph, but you can see here the high water content, the cold end, the low water content on the hot end, and you can see that the chloride started out, this dashed line at the bottom was the starting concentration of chloride. You can see that the chloride was put in all at this end of the column, and over the 22 days that it took to do this experiment, the chloride has moved, the peak is out of about 6 centimeters, and some of it has even gone as far as 8 centimeters. Now, remember that the water's moving in this direction. The water's moving from the hot to the cold. The chloride's moving from the cold to the hot, and so the mainly vapor flow is moving the water back to the cold end, but the liquid return flow is carrying the salt with it and resulting in this distribution of chloride in the sample. Well, there's a lot more that we could say about this early work that Glendon did in his for his PhD, but don't have time for that. He eventually moved on to doing the work that he's best known for, I think, at Hanford. And if any of you know about Hanford, that's the Washington Eastern Desert. Rainfall there is pretty low, below 10 inches a year. And so he was studying pretty dry soils there. It's kind of interesting to me that early work that Glendon did during his graduate school days was foreshadowed the things that he would make contributions in throughout his professional career, that he worked on heat and water movement, mostly in dry soils, and he worked with nuclear radiation, and those are things that areas where he made contributions throughout his career. Working at Hanford, he needed to measure pretty dry soils. And this is one of his papers where he shows some of the problems that you get into when you try to measure or infer water potential in dry soils. These are some measurements of water potential on a pressure plate after the pressure plate had supposedly equilibrated. And you can see that the actual water potentials, they're all supposed to be up here at 1500. You can see that the values that you actually get on the pressure plate are oftentimes not even close to 1500. And so we needed to come up with some other ways to deal with these dry soils. And so he was the one that kind of pioneered this idea of using when he started with it, it was a water activity meter. It was built for use with foods, not with soils. But he took that water activity meter and applied it to the measurement of water potential in these dry soils. And this is one that's now built more specifically for soils, but along the same lines as the one that Glendon used, but will read pretty quickly, still gives good enough resolution for a lot of measurements in the wet range, but will go actually to measurements beyond air dry. The principle is shown here. There's a mirror inside cooled by a Peltier cooler. The dew on the mirror is read with an optical sensor. There's also an infrared thermometer that reads the temperature of the sample. And from the dew point temperature and the sample temperature, we can compute the water potential, and it's roughly proportional to the dew point depression. Here are some of the moisture release curves that Glendon published that came from these measurements with that water activity meter for a Palouse soil and a Royal, and then some comparisons with thermocouple psychrometer that were made on the same samples. You can see that these moisture release curves cover an enormous range. They're not just limited to the plant growth range, but go all the way down. I mean, they extrapolate to this point at 1,000 minus 1,000 megapascals, which is approximately the water potential of oven dry soil. And interesting that they extrapolate through that point, that the point that we call zero of water content is the water potential of oven dry soil, which is, of course, about what you'd expect. And if we plot it on a semi-log basis, or if we could say plot water content versus PF, as is used in Europe for a measure of water potential, we get approximately a straight line relationship. Now this does go dry enough so that you can measure Hanford soils with it, obviously, that if I can get the pointer up here, that this is maybe somewhere around air dry, and we can go even a ways below that. And so you can see that Glendon finally had an instrument that he could use in Hanford and get make measurements as dry as he wanted to make. One of the big issues at Hanford was to measure the flux of water. Is water moving down? If it's moving down, how fast is it moving down? Those kinds of questions were ones that Glendon spent a lot of time working on. And the result of that work was this, it's called the GI passive capillary lysimeter. Essentially, it's a funnel that has a fiberglass wick in the bottom of it. You can see a diagram here, the funnel. There's going down here, usually it's about 60 centimeters long, and then at the bottom of the funnel there's a tipping bucket rain gauge that measures the amount of water that goes through. At the top there's this, what's called a divergence control tube. Now Glendon was not the first one to come up with the fiberglass wick for a lysimeter. But I think he may have been the first to use this divergence control tube as a way to sample correctly the vadose zone. These are some simulations, again out of one of Glendon's papers, that show on the y-axis the ratio of the flux through the lysimeter to the flux around it, and on the x-axis, the height of that control tube. And what you would like is to have this come out to be about 1. And you can see that when you get up to a fairly high divergence control tube, it is close to 1. So this is a 10-centimeter divergence control tube, and usually the divergence control tubes are up around this length. And you can see that for this particular set of simulations, that a divergence control tube in the range of what Glendon would have recommended is about the right length. From this analysis and other simple analyses that you can do, you can come up with a few conclusions. One conclusion is that the divergence control tube is typically more effective than the wick. Another is that the divergence errors are the largest when the flow is lowest, but the events are deep drainage events mainly occur when the flux is high, and so this is a good part of the design. And in fine-textured soils, they're large, but the soils are pretty coarse-textured at Hanford. And so, again, the passive capillary lysimeter works pretty well. Now, Glendon has contributed in many ways to both to the instrumentation and to the understanding. One thing that needs to be understood, I think, is that there's a lot of nasty stuff at Hanford that was put there as a result of the activities generating the plutonium that went into the plutonium bombs in World War II. And that stuff could move down with water. The doctrine at Hanford before Glendon got there was that there was no downward movement of water at Hanford because the potential evapotranspiration was so much greater than the precipitation that it was impossible for there to be downward flow. The measurements that Glendon and his associates made at Hanford during his career established unequivocally that there was substantial downward movement, especially in areas that were bare and had coarse-textured soils, and those are exactly the areas where the worst stuff is located. So I think what we can say is thank you, Glendon, for the things that you've contributed to our science, but thank you even more for the things that you've contributed to us.